almost a year ago, I did a wedding for a wonderful couple in our congregation. I got to say, it was probably one of the more beautiful weddings I have ever done. It was at an incredible mansion, old historic home in Sierra Madre, and it was fancy and glorious. And throughout the wedding, during that day, I wanted to make sure that I did my job correctly, other than just officiating the wedding. But for those of you who probably, you know, been to a wedding or two, you would know that one of the major and most important jobs of the officiant is to sign the wedding certificate along with the couple. And so throughout the rest of the day after the ceremony, I kept going to the wedding coordinator and to the couple and reminding them, hey, we cannot forget, we have to sign the wedding certificate at some point today. Because I knew that they were going to be leaving town, and if they didn't sign it, then I don't know, would they be official or would they not be official? And so as the evening went on, it was a Saturday night, and on Saturday nights, I tend to not be fully present. My brain is already on Sunday mornings, especially if I'm preaching. I'm thinking about my sermon. I'm thinking about the Sunday morning duties. And so when the dance floor started lighting up a little bit, I turned to Jeff and I thought, well, I'm feeling a little sleepy. Maybe we should go home and I can study my sermon for a little bit. So we said our goodbyes, we hopped in the car and we got home, and I got into my pajamas and I'm in bed and I'm reading through my sermon. And on Saturday nights, I sometimes have to take melatonin just to help me sleep a little bit, just to the nervousness of the next day. And so I'm in bed and all of a sudden my phone starts to ring and I look and I think, oh, it's the groom. Oh, it's the groom. We forgot to sign the wedding certificate. And so I sat up and I talked to him and he said, hey, yeah, we're still here. We're going to be leaving town soon. Are we going to sign that wedding certificate? I'm like, yes, I will be right over. Problem was, I had taken melatonin, and you're not really supposed to drive a vehicle after you've taken melatonin. But thankfully, my in-laws were in town and Jeff was able to drive me. And I thought, you know what? The venue needed everyone out at a certain time, so I'm sure it's just the couple and I can just kind of sneak in my pajamas and we'll sign their certificate and it'll be no big deal. So we got in the car and we pulled back up to this big, glorious, beautiful, historic mansion there. And there are just swarms of crowds of people just pouring out of this. And it just was almost like one of those red carpet moments. You know, everybody kind of moved away as I got out of the vehicle, except I got out of the vehicle in my pajamas. And as I stepped out of the vehicle, I just was humbled more and more at each moment. And thinking that we were just going to go into the back room and sign a wedding certificate, actually, nowadays, it's a moment. I mean, they're snapping pictures, they're getting photo ops, and I'm standing there in my pajamas, and one of the groomsmen makes a comment. He's like, huh, never seen a pastor in pajamas before. Thinking, oh, this is just absolutely humiliating. And so to this day, the couple and I, we joke about it, and it's certainly a story that they will perhaps tell their children when they're looking through the wedding album and there's the pastor signing the wedding certificate in her pajamas. But that was a humbling moment at a very festive occasion. And I broke some serious wedding etiquette, I'm pretty sure. And probably some pretty serious clergy etiquette. It was a humbling moment. And in our text today, Jesus creates a very humbling moment for the clergy or the religious leaders or the Pharisees or the experts of the law. He creates a humbling moment through a very humbling teaching and a very festive occasion. And last week, as we walked through our text, we acknowledged that the Pharisees were probably wondering if Jesus had taken his happy pills or not, as Jesus really leaned into the Pharisees in uncomfortable ways. And this week, he does it again. He really leans into the Pharisees. And this week, the Pharisees probably not only wonder if Jesus has forgotten to take his happy pills, they probably wonder if he has forgotten to take his crazy pills. To them, he's seeming to lose it a little bit. Let's take a look at our text from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 14, beginning at verse 1. And we're going to read all the way through verse 14. And so you can follow along in your bulletins, or we'll also have the text up here on this screen, or you can also pull out your Bibles. Again, Luke's Gospel, chapter 14, beginning at verse 1, and we're going to scroll all the way through verse 14. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee who was being carefully watched, there in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and the experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?" And they had nothing to say. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. "When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person is more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, 'Give this person your seat.' Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, 'Friends, move up to a better place.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." Then Jesus said to his host, "When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." This ends the reading. This is the word of the Lord. Are we thankful today? Thanks be to God. It would seem as though the Pharisees are a tad bit obsessed with Jesus. In fact, right at the beginning of this text, it says that the Pharisees were watching Jesus carefully. It is the day of the Sabbath, and Jesus is doing exactly what a good rabbi should be doing, and he is observing the Sabbath, and he is now celebrating the Sabbath day over a Sabbath meal with the Pharisees, and the Pharisees seem to be stalking Jesus. They want to keep a close look at him. And so it's not immediately clear as to why Jesus was invited to this meal, but perhaps it's because they wanted to watch him. They wanted to see, they wanted to scrutinize whether or not he was following the law, whether or not he was honoring the law and honoring the Sabbath. And so it should have been no surprise here that the events that did unfold. But Jesus uses this opportunity to create a rather humbling moment for the Pharisees, and one that they likely resisted. And in walks a person in this scene who did not really belong. A man with dropsy walks in who clearly needed some healing, love, and compassion. And so Jesus turns to the Pharisees and he asks them what seems like maybe a trick question to them. He says, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" And they remained completely silent, probably recalling a few other episodes where Jesus leaned in. And so they probably recognized that maybe this was a setup question. And if they answered wrong, it could create another awkward moment. And so they remained silent. And so Jesus leans in and he heals this man with dropsy. Now, dropsy would have been something where there would have been swelling at the limbs because of kidney or heart issues. And so Jesus leans in and he heals him. And then he gives a parable. He says, "Now, if you have a child or an ox that falls into the well on a Sabbath day, would you not help them out?" And again, they remain silent. You see, what Jesus was revealing here, Jesus, of course, believed in honoring the Sabbath. But the issue here was that the religious leaders and the experts of the law, they over time began to create laws on top of laws or rules on top of rules on top of rules. And they missed out on the intent behind the law altogether. So it wouldn't have been uncommon for them to stand around and be having conversations. Can you do this and still honor the Sabbath? Can you still pick up a fork? Or can you still pick up a utensil? Or is that breaking the Sabbath? And so there would have been intense conversation on whether or not it was lawful to heal or not heal. Is that work or is that work? And as a result, through all of these rules heaped up on top of one another, hearts had become hardened and they had forgotten about the most important command, and that is loving God and loving your neighbors. And so as they're having this conversation and after the healing, Jesus, then he looks around the room and he looks at how people are seated. And he notices where those who are sitting in a place to cement their seat of honor, if you will. And he says this. He says another parable. He says, if you go to a wedding banquet, don't immediately go and seek out the seat where you have the most honor. Because that could be really humiliating. Because what could end up happening is someone greater than you, someone more distinguished or someone more prominent than you could come in and the host could ask you to give up your seat, and then you're going to be humiliated and you'll have to move all together. He says, instead, if you're invited to a wedding banquet or if you're invited to a festive occasion, take the lowest place. Because then you could be elevated to a higher place. He says, so those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humbled themselves will be exalted. And then Jesus looks and he sees the one in the prominent position. That is the one who invited him. And he says, and you, if you have a lunch or if you have a dinner, don't just invite others who are of equal social status. Don't just invite those who could repay you and invite you to a party that is also great. Don't just invite your friends and your family and the people that you love and the people that are like you and the people who are also prominent. But instead, invite those who cannot repay you with an invitation back. In other words, invite the crippled, the lame, and the blind. He says, and then you will be blessed. They may not be able to repay you with an equal dinner party, but you will be blessed. And so what Jesus is doing here is he's stepping into an honor and shame framework, and he's turning a very common world view upside down by painting a vision of the character and the goodness of the kingdom. Again, he's peeling back the curtains and he's helping them see just a little bit more exactly what the kingdom of God is like and how the people of God are to live as citizens of the kingdom. And what we have to understand is in this honor and shame society is that status was everything. Prestige mattered greatly. And finding moments to publicly put one's display or to publicly put one's status on display and to publicly put one's prestige on display was a good moment. And meals were the place to do this. Where people sat mattered. What they ate mattered. And it was a public advertisement of who's who. It was a public advertisement of who was prominent. And you would only invite others who would help cement that status. You would only invite others who were greater than you or equal than you. And if you were in a position of power or privilege, you would never invite someone who can't repay that invitation. And you would never invite someone that would endanger your status or invite someone that would endanger your privilege. You would always do something that would help advance, elevate, or equalize your status. And so Jesus' words, we've got to understand, for us as Christians, it may sound somewhat familiar to us, but these words were a far cry from what the religious leaders understood in that day. You see, to lose social status would be to lose honor. But we know, as we've been journeying with Jesus since the manger in Advent, we know that this moment isn't so abrupt, that this is not an odd parable for Jesus. It was odd for them, but it was not odd for Jesus. In fact, we see this right away at the announcement of the birth of Jesus. Mary stands up when she receives this good news and she takes it in and she begins to sing this incredible Magnificat as she says, he has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones. He has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but sent the rich away empty. Again, we hear this worldview of status and symbols and prestige and those at the top of the society. Jesus, he begins to lay this level, this playing field and level it out. And we see this proclamation right here in Mary's Magnificat that in the goodness of God's plan, that a re-socialization of society would begin to happen. And it wouldn't happen through rebellion or war. It wouldn't happen by force or coercion or might, but instead it would happen through the meekness of a child born in the margins, in the darkness and the hiddenness of night. And you can imagine those who are not prominent, those who are not at the top of the society, those who are at the margins, you can imagine them rejoicing at this good news. And then in Luke's gospel, chapter 4, just a couple of chapters later, Jesus announced there in the synagogue that he has come to bring good news to the poor. And now, as he stands here at this dinner table among the religious elite, he begins to speak into their lives. And again, he begins to flip this worldview upside down. And he begins to make a declaration of who the good news is for and those who receive the good news exactly how they are to embody it. Now, John Dixon, who writes this incredible book on humility, he notes that in this culture, one's understanding of humility had more to do with humility before someone who is greater than you. In fact, it wouldn't have been uncommon for a rabbi to say something along the lines of, "We are humble before God. We recognize that God is great and that we are not. And we also recognize those who are of higher status that we also ought to be humble before them. And then we ought to lend an ear to the poor." Which sounds really great. But what Jesus is saying here, Jesus is not only saying we must be humble before God and those who are greater than us, but we actually are not just to lend an ear to the poor, but we are to lower ourselves. Not just lend an ear, but to lower ourselves, to humble ourselves. And Jesus, as he steps into this, he begins to speak that greatness is not over and above, but greatness is lowering. Greatness is lowliness, and greatness is submissiveness, and greatness is humility. It's exactly what Jesus says in Mark's Gospel chapter 10 when he says, "Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." And we see the embodiment of this and the most humiliating death that the Roman world had to offer. As Jesus lowered himself to depths unimaginable, brought to the lowest place imaginable, death by crucifixion. And it's no wonder then, as Jesus lowers himself into depths beyond our imagination, that Jesus moves in and begins to speak into this culture and time again, demand a better way. A way where others aren't invited just because we can be repaid, but where those who can't be repaid are elevated and invited. A way where others are honored, a way where self-serving agendas are laid down and surrendered, a way where social boundaries that cemented one's status and place of prominence are obliterated, a way where insider and outside language no longer exists, a way where power and privilege is distributed and shared, a way where those who are of lower status are now elevated, and where those who are of higher status stoop down low to redistribute and empower and share, a way where those who are marginalized and invisible in society are now seen, a way where there is no longer a huge vast between the wealthy and the poor, a way where hospitality is given freely without any expectations of anything coming back in return, a way where the outside is now seen as those who are brother and sister and friend, and a way where selfless generosity is offered to those in the margins of society. Jesus steps into this world and declares that the kingdom of God that is presently bursting forth and all of those who live under the reign and rule of King Jesus, this is the people of God in which he is creating and in which this society is being formed. This is the way of the kingdom and the way of humility. You see, we talk a lot about humility as Christians. It's an important and central topic for us. And we sing songs like, humble thyself in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. But here's the way that we often think about and talk about humility. We see someone win an award and what do they say? Oh, gee, I'm so humbled by this. Thank you. And when we receive compliments, we say, oh, I'm just so humbled by this. And you see, oftentimes we talk about humility in ways that are sometimes more false humility. Or though as it's just a state of mind and a scent of the heart. And oftentimes we paint the picture of humility as I need to focus on all of my brokenness. I need to focus on all of my sinfulness and really just sit and think about how awful I am compared to the greatness of God. And that's where we go with our conversations on humility. I need to remember I'm terrible. I need to remember that I'm broken. I need to remember that I'm fallen, that I'm cracked, all of these things. And I need to remember how great God is, and I must never forget that. I love the way that Scott McKnight puts it when he talks about, he unpacks this idea of humility as one's comprehension before God only. He says it like this. He says, focusing on our cracks does not inevitably produce humility. He said, humility is a positive, sinfulness is a negative. Humility is noted by joy and graciousness and love and honor and the like. And what we see in this text right here when Jesus teaches this profound lesson on humility is Jesus says very little of that humility is one's comprehension before God, that God is great and I am not. And while that is absolutely true and we must recognize that God is great and holy and yes, that there is a depravity, we must remember that. But it seems to me that the type of humility that Jesus steps in and teaches is not just one's comprehension before God, but he takes it a level further. Humility is something we do. Humility is something we embody. Humility is something that is practiced. It is done. John Dixon puts it like this. He says, humility is the noble choice to forego your status, deploy your resources, or use your influence for the good of others before yourself. Humility isn't just this ascent of the heart. It's not just this recognition that I am just a lowly servant, broken and sinful, and God is great. But it seems to me that Jesus is pushing and stretching our imagination that actually humility is something we do. It is a choice to forego our status. It is a choice to take on the posture of the cross and to lower ourselves and to forego status, as John Dixon puts it. In other words, it is a willing choice to give up, to give away, to deploy, and to lower oneself. It's not choosing the seat of honor always, but instead it's stepping aside and offering it to someone other than ourselves. Humility is stepping back and saying, you first. Humility is listening instead of speaking first. Oh, and humility is listening not to just have a comeback, but it's listening to understand, to learn, to perhaps recognize, maybe I don't know it all. Maybe I am wrong. Probably I am wrong. Humility is an act of choice to step back and recognize all that we have been given is gift from God and deploying it for the kingdom instead of my status, instead of my gain, instead of my own elevation, but for others. And so perhaps what Jesus is getting at by this simple yet uncomfortable illustration as he speaks into the Pharisees and begins to push them, stretch their imagination, that humility is not just one's comprehension before God and those who are greater than us, but humility is an act of choice to lower oneself and to not assume the seat of honor, but instead to step aside. And so perhaps humility is not some big, great, and grand gesture, but perhaps the life of humility is a daily in and out practice. In the small moments, not in the grand ones, not in the ones that are going to make the LA Times or Facebook, not the ones that are going to make the selfie moments, but the moments that go unnoticed in the hidden spaces. And the moments where there's no one there to applaud or pat you on the back or notice what a great job you're doing. It's in the daily, the small. It's in the practicing of perhaps standing in line at a grocery store with just a couple of items. Maybe you're in a hurry, but you notice a young mom standing back there with four or five children and groceries overloading, and she's clearly stressed. Perhaps the practice of humility is in the daily just stepping aside and saying, you know, why don't you go first? Perhaps it's in the moment of you being there and your blinker is on and this is my parking space. I've been waiting here. Don't you dare turn into that. Never done that. Just yesterday I did that. But perhaps it's giving up the parking space. Or perhaps it's in the rocking of the children in the nursery. No one there to notice or pat your back. But you're there. Or perhaps in the moments of wiping off the snot of a child during Sunday school. No one's going to pat you on the back for that. Or perhaps it's volunteering in the office on a weekly basis to support a pastor or two. Or perhaps it's giving up time in your schedule to visit a shut-in. A moment where there's no pictures or no one there to applaud you, but you're just there to be present. Perhaps it's sitting and listening to someone with radically different views. Maybe you've gone hand to hand, head to head combat with them on social media, and perhaps it's saying, let's have coffee. I want to listen to you. Or perhaps it's admitting that you might be wrong, that you could be really wrong. Whatever it might be for you, dear Paznaz, won't always be a big and grand gesture. Because I believe that what Jesus is getting at here is that the life of humility is not grand. It's not going to have selfies or pictures. It's not going to have a stadium of individuals applauding. But instead, it's lowering oneself. The way of Jesus. It's the way of the cross. And so as our worship team is coming forward, I want to invite you to consider, what would it look like for you? Maybe perhaps beginning this morning to begin practicing humility. You see, the thing is about practicing some of these virtues that we talk about, and this one being humility. If something begins to happen, when we give up our place in line for a mama to go through, that might be really hard and it's not going to feel good at first. Or I had my blinker on, this is my spot, it's not going to feel great to let the other person in. And it might be just labor intensive to pull weeds on Sunday or Saturday or paint those walls at our work day. But the thing is, when we begin to practice it, something begins to happen through what we call a means of grace. As the Spirit of the living God in those moments begins to work, begins to chisel, begins to shape, begins to form. And in our relationship with Jesus, as we are practicing, we are doing these moments of humility, even when we're not feeling it. In those practice moments, God begins to shape us and form us. And before we know it, we are taking on the posture of the cross. And we're starting to look a little bit more like Jesus. Humble, lowering, and bearing witness to the table in which Jesus imagined. And so I wonder this morning, if Jesus were to step in to our church and look at the tables where we sit, what kind of grade would we get? What would he say? I do believe that by the grace of God, his grace is constantly being poured out. And he'd tell us it's not too late. And to go. And to do likewise. And to practice humility and the way of the cross. Pasnaz, I've shared this so many times, but I long for us, all of us, to be a church that is imitators of Jesus and that looks like Jesus.